Amen. Solomon's writings, we're going to start with the book of Proverbs because it's probably the most commonly read. It's the most popular, I guess, or one of the most popular books of the Bible, simply because you don't necessarily have to be a follower of Christ to find the book of Proverbs fascinating. You know, there are people that are secular in their lifestyle, but yet will read the book of Proverbs and will memorize certain things. Basically, a proverb is a short, principled saying. It's based on a moral principle, and it's meant for you to memorize these things. If you can memorize a proverb, it's got a moral background, moral principle, and it helps you in your life. You know, my personal favorite, and probably many of yours, is chapter 3, verse 5, when it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. That's a saying that I can memorize, and it's got a powerful meaning to it, a moral principle behind it. And Solomon knew 3,000 of these things. 3,000 of these proverbs Solomon could quote and speak. And whether Solomon collectively wrote the book of Proverbs, or if other scholars who heard and knew and read the writings of Solomon culminated these into a book, we don't know. There's 31 chapters of these proverbs, and we know that he is the predominant writer. I think there's only two chapters out of the 31 that was other writers. There was two other individuals, can't remember their names now, and one is Lemuel and Agur or whatever, two fellows that we would probably never read about anywhere else, but they shared in giving some proverbs out of the book of Proverbs. And what is the purpose of this? Solomon is primarily, and as we're going to read today, writing this to the young men. And of course, we don't know at what time period of his life he's writing this. This could be a culmination of years. He spent 40 years on the throne, and throughout his life, he could have just culminated or collected these proverbs and put them into this format. But it's basically him trying to teach young people to guide their lives and to give them guidance. They're basically that in other forms of the, in other parts of the nation or the country or world, I should say, there were other philosophers and people of knowledge who considered themselves to be wise. You know, we in our high schools teach us of Socrates, who taught Plato, and he also taught Aristotle, and they were all looking for the meaning of life and to give their own principles of life. They came way after Solomon, and did they read Solomon's Proverbs? We don't know, but we as Christians follow God's man, and Solomon is certainly him. Some of the things that when I was studying this, it gave a collection of some of the topics that are discussed in the book of Proverbs for those who want to increase their wisdom in these topics. Topics such as personal conduct, business affairs, obtaining wealth, charity, ambition, sex, discipline, debt, child rearing, character, the use of alcohol, politics, revenge, godliness, and a whole host of other things. These are topics that the wisest man of his day felt like he wanted to express through moral principles of how to deal with these topics. So as we read the Bible and learn of Christ and learn of the prophetic in the Old Testament pointing the way to Christ, we come across the book of Proverbs as a way of trying to hone in our own discipline in how we are to conduct ourselves in all of the affairs that affect our daily lives. How should we be as godly men and women? Can we learn from Solomon and how to deal with all of these topics? Is there a direction that we can take? And the book of Proverbs is certainly out to do that. Now, the lesson text in front of us today only gives us the first 7 verses of chapter 1. This is only the introduction as to why the book of Proverbs is even being collected or written. you know, you'd have to go home now and read the rest of the 30 chapters to really engage in knowledge about the wisdom that Solomon brings. But in the first seven verses, he's going to explain basically what his purpose in writing the book is all about. And it says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. To know," and this is the purpose, "to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive or understand the words of understanding, to know the difference between wise counsel and strange and foolish counsel," is what that's saying. "To receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment, and equity." They have chosen those four words as a reason for why the book of Proverbs is going to help you, because it's not only bringing you wisdom, but it's showing you the way of justice and judgment, which go hand in hand. Justice and judgment go hand in hand. Equity, which is a fairness and equality. To give subtlety or prudence or direction to the simple. Now, this is his purpose, to give direction to the simple. There's not necessarily the simple-minded. The simple meaning those that easily follow whatever wind is blowing. Those that will believe. Have you ever come across someone that will believe anything they hear? If they hear something, they run with it. They believe it. That's a simple person that Solomon is saying to give direction and prudence to those individuals. To know, what am I hearing? Is it something to follow or something to reject? To the young man, to give knowledge and discretion. Discretion is a powerful word there. Discretion meaning the ability to act and say or speak without offense. Boy, that's tough. To be able to act and speak without giving offense to the person you're speaking to. That's discretion. Knowing what to hold back. I can speak, but I need to hold back because what I could reveal could be offensive to this person. That's discretion. And what Solomon's purpose is to mold these young men who are going to read this book into not only giving them, making them think about what they're about to say and do, but to give them knowledge of wisdom and things of that nature. So in verse 5, it says, "A wise man will hear and will increase in his learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels." A man of understanding knows who he's listening to and directs himself to listen to men and women of wise counsel, not to hang around foolishness. There's the age-old direction I read one time where it says, if you find yourself to be the smartest man in the room, you're in the wrong room. You need to find another room where people are smarter than you. Wise counsel. You know, seek wise counsel and not foolish counsel. To understand a proverb. When someone of wise counsel gives you a moral principle, gives you a statement, a saying, to be able to understand it and its interpretation, the words of the wise, and it says their dark sayings, which is another way of saying their riddles. So many times you'll hear philosophers and the words of the wise men as they put it in different terminology, which it can be dark and misunderstood, and to be able to reveal and open this up and understand it, that's the purpose of trying to learn and to understand Proverbs, is to be able to dissect it. And he concludes his first seven verses that introduce the book of Proverbs by probably the most powerful of scripture of the other previous six. He is introducing his book by saying, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and despise instruction." You know, young people sometimes will need to learn how to follow instruction. They don't like to be instructed naturally. The Adamic nature in young, wild kids that are just growing up and learning to be sat down and says, you must understand, you must seek wise counsel, you need to learn how to enjoy instruction, is antipathy of the young people. They don't like to do that. They don't like to seek instruction. But Solomon is saying that is where fools lie, is when they disdain or dislike instruction. So when we get into this, the fear of the Lord, it's not the fear of God as meaning, we've talked about this many times, the fear he's talking about is not a fear of him and to where you don't want to communicate with him, you don't want anything to do with God. It's not a physical or a mental fear. It is a fear of reverence and awe, of knowing you are the created and you have a creator. And that creator is where all wisdom and knowledge and instruction culminates from, it flows from. And to start with the knowledge that there is a superior being, and to know that that's my reverence, that's my point of influence, that is where I hope to, that's where I want to seek, is his wisdom coming down from him. That is what it's all about, is when he says to fear the Lord. If you don't have that fear of God, then you will only start trusting in your own abilities. You'll start worshiping yourself and whatever knowledge you can obtain. And without that all-inspiring reverence for God to be your leader and your guide, to open doors for you, to close the ones that can harm you, to lead you to wise counselors, to lead you to a place where he would want you to learn and be instructed by the proper people. That's why we follow God in so many different factors, is we want him to be the one walking our, guiding our pathway, so that as we're seeking instruction, he will open the doors for the right people to instruct us. That's what we're wanting. That's the wise counsel that we're after. So Proverbs, all of us have read the book of Proverbs, and we can probably all quote several ones that we do enjoy and like, and they all lead us and guide us in various forms. But that's one of the books that we never really get tired of learning, because it's so hard for our flesh, which constantly seeks self-gratification, to discipline itself enough to where we can take these Proverbs and completely conquer them to a point where we manifest them totally. We continually have to grow in this, remind ourselves. That's why we read the book of Proverbs over and over, to remind us that this is where I'm falling short. This is what I need to remind myself. Because in life's journey, we never know what type of temptation, trial, or circumstance we're going to find. And everything we run into in our life is covered in the book of Proverbs and how to act and react to it. He covers every part of your life and how you should react to it. And we have to continually gain knowledge from this and remind ourselves, because one time we read it, we may not be going through the very thing that he's given us instruction for. So we're constantly trying to ingrain it into our brains. As we complete the book of Proverbs, we get into a second book that has caused a lot of controversy through the years. The Song of Solomon, I would dare say that more people have questioned, why in the world is the book of Song of Solomon even in the Bible? If you do attempt to read the Song of Solomon, you come away from it a little bit blushed and a little bit surprised, probably, because it seems as if it's a total love story. And it is. It's a book kind of love poems between two lovers. And when you think of Solomon, all right, we just came out of the book of Proverbs, where he's given us all this instruction and wise counsel, and we go into the Song of Solomon, and we find ourselves in a different fantasy land of where two lovers are reaching out for each other and writing love poems to each other, and we're wondering, what has this got to do with me at all? You know, why would it be included in the Bible? We look back at Solomon's life, and it is a little bit reflective of who he was as well. We know from last week's lesson that he married 700 women, had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Solomon, without a doubt, enjoyed the pursuit of women. He enjoyed the relationships that happened between man and woman. He enjoyed the romanticism of men and women. It was obvious he didn't just do this just because it was a game. He enjoyed it. And as he is writing this, we believe that he wrote it in his younger days, when the pursuit was at its height and when he was collecting, I guess you could say. He wrote this in a way of expressing all that we can gather from the Song of Solomon, talking about love itself. As I wrote something down here, it says, the Song of Solomon is a collection of love poems that capture the joys, the insecurities, the frustrations and the sorrows that accompany the journey of love. Through the eyes of two lovers, Solomon in his book is trying to express, because he knows that every human being goes through this type of relationship, through the love of another person, through the attraction to another person, the pursuit of that person. For those that are married, we have a pursuit of the person that we have chosen. And Solomon knows that this is part of life, and he is developing a book, basically of poetry, to talk about the frustrations with it, the joys of it, the sorrows of it. And with it, it gets very explicit. Some have even claimed it to be erotic when you read what he is expressing himself. It shows a little bit of his personality in it as well. It's included in the scriptures because not only is it a help to people who are younger people who are anticipating marriage, you know, the frustrations of it, and what is it like should, you know, as they say in the South, you know, when a girl turns 18, she marries the first boy that makes her laugh. You know, that's an old saying, but anyway, we don't do that. We want to find God's person for us and pursue that person, all right? And what the Song of Solomon is doing is it's giving examples through poetry of how intense that pursuit can be, the drive, the romantic attraction. It's also designed to show a relationship between Christ and the church. This gives me a little bit of an answer as to why was it included in the scriptures. Not only was it there for young people to understand, to read, and know that marriage is more than just some agreement between two families. It's more than just, you know, I've turned 18 and I got to get married now. It's a big deal. It's a pursuit. And it should be between two people who truly have this attraction and love for one another, where they're in their early love, that's all they think about, that's all they want to pursue. And he is showing the ups and downs of love, the journey of love. But from a biblical narrative, in the Old Testament, it's included. The Jewish, the people in Judaism included the Song of Solomon in their scriptural writings, not in the Pentateuch, but in referred it as scripture, because they saw it as a draw up from Solomon talking about the love of God between God and Israel, the joys, the frustrations, the pursuit God had for his people, and then they would run away, and then they would come back pursuing him. It was kind of a reflection of that love affair between God and his people. And then in the New Testament, it's included as Christ and his church, and the ups and downs and frustrations and sorrows and joys of the journey of love between Christ and his church. And that's when we read the Song of Solomon, it's not to a point where we're, you know, you're to be, as you know, bashful and ashamed and almost turn red blushed and all that. It's meant to understand that Solomon's purpose in writing this is to show the true factors involved with romanticism, with romantic love between people, between a couple. And he's using a couple. And it's interesting with Solomon is he writes it primarily in the perspective of the woman, which is unusual for biblical writings. Usually biblical writings were, you know, usually from the perspective of the man and given for instruction, like Proverbs was mainly instructions for young men. And yet Song of Solomon, it was from the perspective of the woman as she is pursuing her lover, and her lover is, you know, whether they're coming together or fleeing, and it covers all the different types of the marriage, from the courtship to the consummation to the maturity of marriage, the years of marriage. And it follows the whole Song of Solomon through that full love of two people. It covers all of it. So when Solomon, you know, even though he was someone that we certainly wouldn't follow with all of his multiple wives and concubines, it lets us know that even in his, what would eventually bring him down, you know, the strange women that would lead him astray, he certainly understood the pursuit. And he tried to reflect that it will happen to everyone, and it's not a bad thing. Romantic love is a good thing, and we must do it in God's favor and with God's direction and in God's way. We get to the last book which I want to spend the majority of the time talking about, the book of Ecclesiastes. It's one, if you're a melancholy somewhat like me, you probably find this a little more interesting than others, because the book of Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon near the end of his days. This is kind of like an ex-convict going into a high school and given a talk or a speech to high school students who may be troubled, who may be showing signs of trouble. This is a person who has lived his life, and he's making reflections on what he has done. This is something that, you know, as older people in our church and congregation, one of your frustrations, I'm sure, is looking at the younger generation coming up and seeing the mistakes that they're making. And you have such wisdom yourself that you would like to shake them and say, listen to me. I've done this. I've been there. I know better. Listen to my wisdom so that you don't have to go through what I've gone through. I know better at this stage of my life. And this is what Solomon is basically doing here. Solomon, in all of his wisdom and in all of his wealth, he made a mistake early on by choosing to pursue what he considered happiness. He was given God's wisdom and contentment, but he wasn't content with wisdom. Whenever a young person has that much power, that much wisdom, where he looks out in his courtyard and sees dignitaries from other nations coming just to hear him, when he has 700 wives and 300 concubines that are attending to his every call, when he snaps his finger and he gets whatever he wants and he can accumulate whatever, there is no limit to what he can obtain, it is very difficult for a young man, even with the wisdom of Solomon, to withhold that or to stay content or to stay within the bounds of where God wanted him to be. Remember his desire when God asked him, what do you want me to give you? He didn't ask for riches. He didn't ask for wealth. He didn't ask for long life. He asked for wisdom for one reason, and that was to be a leader of this great people. To make wise judgment and decisions upon this great people was his desire. And God was pleased with that, because he was pleased that Solomon's only wish was to give me everything that I need to benefit you, so that in my life I can do what you've given me to do and produce it, and you get the glory, and I stay in my lane. I stay with what you gave me. God was pleased, and he gave it to him. But with that gift, God also told him, I'm going to make you, because you didn't ask for riches, I'm going to give you riches. Because you didn't ask for honor and things, I'm going to give you that. But if you turn away from me, you're not going to have long life. Solomon, even though he knew where his lane was, whether it was in his youth, whether it was in his personality, whether it was just the temptations of life or Satan himself trying to destroy Solomon, he chose to pursue meaningful life outside of his lane. He couldn't stay content with just being full of wisdom. He had to try to, there's got to be something more to life than what I've been handed. And I want to read out of the book of Ecclesiastes. There's only 12 chapters here. And the first seven chapters basically describe all the worldly things under the sun, as he would put it. I think he put under the sun about 28 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And he talks about all these things. And I just want to kind of scan over chapter 2, where it says, I said in my heart, go to now. I will prove therewith mirth. Mirth is a word meaning amusements, hobbies. I will surround myself with amusements. He's seeking something. He's seeking more than what God has given him. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. And behold, this is also vanity, useless, meaningless. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, amusement, what doeth it? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine. Maybe meaningful life is in enjoyment of alcoholic drunkenness. I gave in to wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom and in lay hold of folly till I might see what was that good for the sons of men. I made me great works. He got into architecture. Maybe I can find pleasure in building my kingdom, building bigger barns, more exaggerated and elaborate palaces. Maybe I can surround myself with all of that I can do architecturally and find this. I build me houses. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and orchards. I planted trees and all kinds of fruits. I made pools of water to water wherewith therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got servants and maidens and had servants born in my house, and I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem ever before me. I gathered also silver and gold and peculiar treasure of kings and other provinces. I got men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men of musical instruments and that of all sorts. And whatsoever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. Whatever I wanted, I obtained. I went after it. Nothing stopped me. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiceth in all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored, and behold, all was vanity, vexation of spirit. There was no profit in them under the sun. This is a man who has sought pleasure. He has sought meaningfulness of life. He has not been content with what God has given him. He's a man who's got the ability to obtain everything that the world has. He has tried everything that man could ever want. And in the end, in his old age, he is sitting back and reflecting on all, searching in his mind, the palaces, the wealth, the luxuries, the amusements, the hobbies, everything that he could have, and he realized it was all meaningless, worthless in the meaningfulness of life. That's the first seven chapters that he talks about this. He's teaching people that would listen to him as an older person of wisdom, saying, I've done it, I've tried it, and here's where the end of it comes from. It's not worth seeking. It's not worth going after. It's not going to give you what you're wanting. It typically will draw you away from God. And he concludes with the matter on chapters 8 through 12 in Ecclesiastes, where most people who are wanting to find Solomon, please come back to God. Is there any indication in all the Bible that Solomon came back to God? If you're looking for that, it may, although it's not explicit, it may be in chapters 8 through 12 of Ecclesiastes, because he realizes that outside of relationship with God, outside of being with God, everything else that you try to put in your life is meaningless. But with God, even the small things are expanded in life. So chapters 8 through 12, as you look at this, he is basically concluding that without God, all life is meaningless and not worth seeking. Sometimes, I had a friend one time who put all of his whole life into his occupation. He worked for a company and he was high up in the company, and he made decisions every day, and he lived his whole life to better the company, to be an important part of that company. And when it came to retirement, he told me later in life, he said, when I decided to retire, I felt really bad because I knew the company would struggle so without me. The company could not continue without me. And he said, to his astonishment, that it did, because he gave an example. And I'll remember this example forever, because he said it was like taking a bucket of water and you put your hand in the bucket. And you believe that your hand, which is surrounded by that water, that when you pull that hand out, there's going to be a hole that cannot be filled. The company cannot last. I've poured everything into this company, but he said, when I pulled my hand out of the water just consumed the hole as if I was never there. Meaningless. And what I took with that is I studied this lesson today about Ecclesiastes and Solomon, who certainly felt that he would have a hole that could not be filled And therefore, he sought to continue to enhance and to give everything. He realized that everything that he accomplished was meaningless in contending for giving him contentment. Just so my friend, who felt that everything that he had put forth in all of his efforts towards a certain occupation, so that he would make a name for himself that would be remembered forever, and it may almost even be the destruction of the company when he leaves, realized that in the end, he was just a figure that could be easily replaced. So, what is Solomon trying to tell us in the book of Ecclesiastes? He is basically someone who is somewhat depressed at this point of his life. He is depressed after seeking satisfaction and happiness in worldly things and pleasures. That is something for all of us to pay attention to. Proverbs helps us to grow, supposedly as young people, to learn before we make the mistakes. Teach us your proverbs, teach us your instruction, and that our minds will be open to that, so that I know how to act and react to people. When things happen to me and when people approach me, give me wisdom through your proverbs and let me memorize these things, that I can bring them back to my memory. But Ecclesiastes is the one where we're sitting in the classroom listening to someone who has already seen it, already done it, found out that nothing that you're seeking beyond God is going to fulfill you. That's a hard lesson for any young person to take, especially with their lives ahead of them, thinking of all the glory that they're going to receive, all the things that they're going to obtain and acquire, where they're going to go, how many children they're going to have, the worldly possessions they may desire. All of that is a good part of life, but without God, and all you do is seek that, it will be meaningless in the end, because it will not fulfill that inward desire that you may not know it, but that you have. There is a spirit inside of you that does want to be reconnected through a relationship with your Creator, and without that relationship, you are always searching to fill that void and that hole. And through your pursuits, you may have the wealth of Solomon, where you could try it all. Some who don't have the wealth and can't try everything will try to do it in other ways that are harmful to them. But in the end, whether you're wealthy or poor, whatever you try to pursue to give you meaningfulness in your life or happiness, the world's got plenty of opportunities. They've got plenty of things for you to try, but none of it fills that void. Ecclesiastes tells us we are very lucky and fortunate to have the book of Ecclesiastes to remind us that our pursuit of God is more important than our pursuit of anything else, because that fulfills us. The other things, the big houses, the fancy cars, they're nice. Everyone loves to enjoy it, pursue it, but don't let it overtake your pursuit of God. With these writings of Solomon, we still, are fascinated by the man, the ups and downs of his life. And, it's a tragedy in a sense of what happened to him. But yet I look back after Ecclesiastes, I was thinking, if he would not have gone downhill, so to speak, after he obtained so many strange women who led him astray, led his heart away after false idols and things of this nature, where once he separated his life from God, he tried to fill it with all the other things. If we wouldn't have had him go through that, would we have Ecclesiastes? If Solomon would have stayed in God's direction or in his pathway and continued to be the wisest man of his day and continue to write books of how-to and instruction, we would have grown from it. But Ecclesiastes has its role because his downfall, which we all hope he repented from and was able to reconnect with God, his downfall led to the book of Ecclesiastes that we can learn so that we don't make the same mistakes. And if the wisest man of his day can make these mistakes, we are susceptible as well. But he left us words of wisdom to follow, and we're never too old to continue to read this. Read it to our young people that they may know. This should be mandatory reading. Proverbs and Ecclesiastes should be mandatory reading for everyone getting in high school or college or whatever, because it is so vital for them to continue to learn and realize the instruction and wanting to be instructed so that you don't make the same mistakes is so vital for your life. We conclude this lesson, or we conclude this curriculum, with the wisdom of Solomon from his beginning all the way to his end, and we still draw on it today. Next week, as we start the fall quarter, we're going to go back and study the patriarchs of the Old Testament, starting, of course, with Abraham. And we can learn from these patriarchs, and we look forward to studying that and bringing that to you next week. Hope you have a good week. Be prepared for the next for the service this morning as we enter into a time of worship, and it's appreciate you coming out today. We'll see you then.